on the captive population of Gaza. We know that these drones have killed people, and we're here today to stop the arms trade overall, but specifically against Elbit.
Palestine Action have always said, if you continue with this violence against the Palestinian people, then we will retaliate, we will resist, we will come back, we will shut down your factories.
The attack by Israel on Nablus is a common occurrence across occupied Palestine. The lack of action by Western powers to rein in Israeli aggression has inspired more aggressive activism. Palestine Action say their relentless raids have successfully forced the closure of two Elbit sites in London and Oldham. A spokesperson for Elbit acknowledged the incident, claiming it was an attack by a violent group. Although no one was harmed during the raid, Palestine Action's sights remain squarely fixed on UAV engines, so locals can expect more of the same scenes going forward. Robert Carter, Shenstone.
Several days ahead of the lunar month of Muharram, people in Afghanistan are preparing to mark the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia Imam and grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, Imam Hussein. On Kabul streets, people have held Muharram exhibitions, where they provide necessities for mourning rituals.
We have been holding such Muharram affairs for more than 20 years. We deploy necessities for mourning ceremonies across Afghanistan. However, Muharram always has its own prosperity, but this year it is very different for our people. As we see, people are set to mark a widespread and more passionate Muharram.
Afghans also turned the mosques and public religious places black to express the emotion of grief on the martyrdom anniversary of their third imam.
We are preparing to hold Muharram mourning ceremonies in Abul Fazl Shrine. The servants and lovers of Imam Hussein are decorating here with black as an old Afghan religious culture. God willing, we will host a sizable population of mourners during Muharram days, especially in Ashura.
With the Taliban responsible for ensuring security, Afghan Muslims, especially Shias, hope that they can hold their festivities in a peaceful space.
As you know, in the past years, there were security threats, especially by the Daesh terrorist group. Now that the invasion has ended and the Taliban are in power, I hope they tighten the security in advance and provide a safe ground for Muharram mourners across the country. They should cooperate and engage with the people and mourners to foil evil schemes.
Muslims around the globe largely commemorate the Battle of Karbala to keep the spirit of resistance and fight against arrogance alive. They also honor Imam Hussein's sacrifices, renewing allegiance with his ideals. Every year, millions of people in Afghanistan passionately mourn the martyrdom of Imam Hussein during the month of Muharram. Now here in the capital city of Kabul, preparations are underway for large processions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The global stage for talents. The 5th International Stage Stars Festival wrapped up with the announcement of winners, who have been competing in four categories of singing, voice acting, show hosting, and sound impression. The top performances from each category won the golden mic and a cash prize.
The festival was a place for more serious competition between those who have a say in a stage performance. I'm so happy to be chosen by the jury as the best show host of the contest.
It was an amazing event for talents. I'm so glad to be part of this. Talents from all across Iran and many parts of the world competed in the festival, so winners should be proud of themselves.
Held in Iran's city of Rafsanjan, the two-day event brought together participants from 14 countries, including Iran, Afghanistan, Kyrgyzstan, Nigeria, and Turkey, to flaunt their knack for stage performance.
The scale of this contest is global. Many of us participants did not have any idea we could be stand-up comedians or show hosts. But when we got on stage here, we ourselves discovered our own talents.
I really love that, seeing that all people around the world are coming here and presenting themselves. It's a very great feeling. Of course, they will be progressed and they will develop yourself when they will got the result.
The jury is comprised of top Iranian actors, TV presenters, and voice artists. They say the competition has been tough, and those who stood out are real stage stars.
We tried our best to pick talents who really acted like professionals on stage. Not only should they care about the standards and principles of a stage performance, but they must innovate, improvise, and stand out.
This festival acted like a university for stage talents. It taught a lot of lessons about the stage to participants, especially for those who failed to win the contest.
Organizers say this contest is not just about scouting for stage talents. They say the event helps shine a spotlight on talents and lead them to their community.
The fifth Stage Stars Festival is aimed at bringing stage talents to light. Many of the participants already have a few years of experience, so this stage is not supposed to discover them, but to springboard them to a higher level in their careers.
All of the contestants, even those who come from foreign countries, must perform in Persian. However, organizers plan to include other languages in the upcoming editions of the festival.
To those who won the golden mic here, this is a dream come true. But they say, aside from the prize, Stage Stars has marked a milestone in their pursuit of success, since they have now come under the spotlight. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Rafsanjan.
A big sit-in was held inside the Red Cross office in the blockaded Gaza Strip on Monday in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners on hunger strike. On Sunday, scores of Palestinian prisoners started a mass hunger strike to support two of their fellow prisoners who have been on hunger strike for several months to protest their administrative detention. Around 500 Palestinian prisoners are being held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for more than 10 years. Their only recourse to draw attention to their plight has been hunger strikes. Among them, Khalil Awaude has been refusing food since March, and Raed Rayan has adopted the same passive resistance approach since April.
Yesterday, dozens of Palestinian detainees from different factions entered an open-ended hunger strike in solidarity with two Palestinian detainees who are going on their long hunger strike protesting the administrative detention, Khalil Awaude and Raed Rayan.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. Families of Palestinian prisoners have slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of their loved ones.
I want to talk about the silence of the international community and the United Nations. I sent many letters about my son's case to all of them to intervene with the Israeli government to talk with them about my son's case, but unfortunately no response from all of them.
Prisoners' advocacy groups also condemned Israel's treatment of the Palestinian prisoners, who are subjected to inhumane and degrading conditions, including solitary confinement and bans on family visits.
Palestinian detainees nowadays are subjected to inhumane practices by Israeli prison services. Therefore, we are here today to convey a message to the international community, especially to the ICRC, to put pressure on the Israeli government to stop such policies and to end the Palestinian suffering, Palestinian detainees' suffering.
Many here believe that the support Israel enjoys from some countries like the United States gives it the green light to act in contradiction with international law regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Statistics show that the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and minors. Among them, some 50,000 administrative detainees. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Algerian Foreign Minister Ramtane Al-Amamra has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus and handed him a letter from Algerian President on bilateral relations and preparations made for the upcoming Arab League summit in Algeria. Assad said the Arab League is the mirror that reflects Arabs' status quo, asserting what matters to Syria is the content and result of joint Arab action rather than the form. Amamra said Syria is a basic element on the Arab arena and that the Arab world needs Syria, not vice versa. He stressed that Algeria will remain standing beside and coordinating with Syria regarding Arab and international developments during its presidency of the Arab League summit. The top Algerian official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart. The two sides agreed to boost economic cooperation and establish a joint higher committee for this purpose. However, the main topic was how to bridge gaps in the relations between Syria and some Arab countries, as Algeria is exerting efforts to bring back Syria to the Arab League.
If you ask Arabs, does Syria have a legitimate seat in the Arab League, the answer would be yes. Is Syria's absence from the Arab League in the benefit of any side? The answer is no. Syria's absence harms joint Arab action. Are there means to solve this situation? This is the core of my consultations with Arab brothers. We are optimistic.
Muqdad asserted that the issue is beyond just attending or not attending the Arab League summit.
We coordinate with Algeria and some Arab countries, regardless of Syria's membership in the Arab League. What is important now is to coordinate policies and come out with conclusions that serve Arab goals. Syria supports all measures that renew Arab stances, solidarity, and an Arab understanding of importance of joint coordination between all of us to face mutual challenges.
Algeria is one of the few Arab countries that remained supportive to Syria during its crisis, as it condemned terror and rejected economic sanctions on Syria.
This is the first official visit of an Algerian foreign minister to Syria in years. It comes as Algeria strives to unite Arab states and enhance Arab-Arab relations ahead of hosting the upcoming Arab League summit in November. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Evidence continues to mount that Europe's sanctions campaign against Russia is exacerbating the euro currency's persistent and perhaps structural economic troubles. France's finance minister just released a depressing outlook. This year's economic growth will be cut almost in half and remain between just 1.4 and 1.8% until at least 2028. The Eurozone's second largest economy now looks too weak to drive what many have long called the world's most unstable macroeconomic bloc. From 2008 to 2017, the Eurozone's average annual economic growth was just 0.6%. From 2018 through 2021, the growth rate was even worse, just 0.5%, putting the Eurozone on track for a second consecutive lost decade. Despite the clear failure of austerity policies in producing growth, President Emmanuel Macron will continue with far-right economics in his second term. His finance minister boasted of plans to cut much-needed public spending to a 20-year low, citing a desire to submit to Brussels' entirely arbitrary 3% rule on public deficits.
We're talking about a systemic crisis in Europe, and one which existed before the crisis caused by the pandemic, as well as the crisis caused by the need to find alternative energy sources other than Russia. What it all adds up to is that a state of crisis continuing still.
This week, the new and deeply fractured National Assembly passed the Emergency Purchasing Power Bill, aimed at countering still-rising, once-in-a-generation inflation. At just 20 billion euros, it has been widely criticized as an ineffective and even superficial measure.
For many people, this bill is insufficient in comparison with the scope of the crisis. The same criticism has been made of a government fuel rebate of 18 cents, which began in April. However, it is 20 billion euros which will help the poorest level of society and students deal with the effects of high inflation.
France's government claims that upcoming austerity rollbacks planned for the pension and unemployment system will actually produce broad economic growth this time. The European Central Bank is raising interest rates, even though the Eurozone is already on the brink of recession. Sanctions and not diplomacy continues to be the destabilizing Western choice regarding Ukraine. The long-term economic outlook for France and the Eurozone appears bleak to many. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Thousands of Palestinians took part in funeral processions of Mohammed Azizi, 25, and Abdurrahman Subh, 28, who were killed early Sunday during an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus and its old town. The Fatah Armed Wing Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade says the two Palestinians were its members, while the Israeli military says the operation in Nablus was launched to apprehend armed suspects. Following the raid, a general strike called across Nablus to mourn the death of the two Palestinians.
The operation this time was more violent than the previous ones. Clashes were heavy as Israeli soldiers raided the neighborhood from all sides. Live ammunitions and rockets were fired towards the houses. I believe such ammunitions are only used in wars between countries.
Israeli forces raided Al-Yasamin neighborhood and surrounded a house, which the regime said Palestinian fighters had barricaded themselves in. Eyewitnesses described the raid as a full-blown military invasion, while the Palestinian Red Crescent reported 19 injuries, including 10 people hit by live fire. The Palestinian leadership has condemned the operation, with a spokesman of the Palestinian president saying the Israeli crime will not defeat the Palestinians and will not break their will.
It's a barbaric act. It's another crime committed by the Israeli forces. They fired rockets at a house and they knew people were inside it. Two young men were killed and many others were wounded. It's obvious that the entire region will remain in a circle of violence until the occupation ends.
At least 52 Palestinians have been killed since late March, as Israel has intensified its aggression after a wave of deadly anti-Israel operations that led to the killing of Israeli soldiers. The Israeli military has never stopped its raids in the occupied West Bank. Such operations have often led to the death and injury of Palestinians, like what happened in Nablus. Regardless of how many people are killed or injured in the raids, Palestinians say resistance is their only option until they free the occupied territories. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely, thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans. And muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Things are heating up again between the U.S. and China. Not that it ever cooled down, but this time China has issued a stern warning to the U.S. It involves the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's planned visit to Chinese Taipei, though not confirmed yet. China says it may have to react militarily. Why would China react to this visit to this degree? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the China-U.S. tensions. Any questions as to why the U.S. is carrying out provocations? We'll be addressing that from Ukraine to West Asia, and then to Asia itself. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Quindo Zhu, senior fellow at Pango Institution, joins us from Beijing. We also have William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review, joining us from Leesburg of VA.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both, gentlemen. William Jones, first over to you. Getting a mixed message in terms of the way the warning has come out. Just a couple days back, we had a warning that said that from China, that if this visit is going to take place, and this warning was supposedly done in private, that there may be a possible military response from China. Now it's not reflected so much in the news, aside from China saying that Washington would bear the consequences if this visit, which is not confirmed yet, were to take place. What's your reading into this?
Well, the warning still holds. It was made, it was done, and they're waiting really for a response. And the response will be either that the trip is somehow canceled or it takes place. And at that point, we will know what the response is. But there hasn't been any ambiguity on the part of the Chinese with regard to how they would react to this thing. This is a serious provocation. It undermines the three communiques. It seems to be, as China interprets it and as most people would see it, a step in the direction of moving away from the three communiques and supporting directly or indirectly China's Taiwan independence. And of course, that's a red line. And so if Pelosi does take this step, I think there will be a very strong reaction. What it will look like is still difficult to say, but I think China cannot not react to this, except that they would accept a greater provocation in the direction which they do not want to go.
Kim Do-ju, one of the responses that came from the Chinese Ministry of Defense, and it was reported in a private call with the U.S., signaled that there could be a military response. And along those statements, quote, if the U.S. insists on taking its own course, the Chinese military will never sit idly by. Do you think that if the trip takes place, many analysts say that's not going to happen, a military response from China. Do you think there will be one or not?
There will be one for sure. There's no doubt about that. It's really about what kind of a military action the Chinese side would take. The people are guessing that the likely choice would be, escorting, the plan of Nancy Pelosi and force it to change that direction. And the Chinese side will not allow the landing of Nancy Pelosi's plan in Taiwan. So in that sense, basically forcing the United States to respect and what it has promised is a commitment to the One China principle. In 1979, when China and the U.S. established the diplomatic ties, the foundation, one of the most important foundation, is that it severed the relationship with Taiwan, Republic of China at that time, and established the relationship with the People's Republic of China. It acknowledges, Beijing is the sole legitimate representative of China, and Taiwan is part of China. And by sending Nancy Pelosi, an official with such a high seniority, that's a serious break or violation of the One China principle. That will undermine the political foundation of the relationship between Beijing and Washington. So China will have to move against that visit, in whatever way. And one of the serious choice is really the military choice here. And there's basically no way for China to step back. Even went out 1 inch, I would say. So, China will respond forcefully and with the military airplanes.
Well, just to make sure that we understand this angle of it correctly here, I'm going to ask you this, William Jones. When you keep reading in the reports that they describe Pelosi as a Democrat who is second in line to the presidency, are they meaning that if there was to be, well, there is, this notion of a military response, that therefore, because of her position, that would pose a national security risk? Is that why they keep mentioning Pelosi in that context?
Well, the reason that Pelosi is significant, not just a congressman going to Taiwan, the Speaker of the House is a part of the U.S. government. It isn't part of the executive branch, but it is an official part of the legislative branch. So that she would have to adhere to the policies of the government, which were accepted by the executive branch as well as the legislative branch. The One China policy is government policy. And so given that position, of course, this means that a high-level U.S. government official is breaking with that One China policy. In Pelosi's case, she's not the second, but the third in line for the presidency, which also puts her in, you know, in a direct line with potentially executive functions, which makes it even more serious. So by doing this, and people are aware of this, and Pelosi is, of course, aware of this as well. And she and other people are intent on trying to push this Taiwan issue to try and, they think, contain China. But what it could effectively do is lead to a military conflict with China. And that's why you have seen the reaction from the Pentagon, which is certainly not pro-Chinese, but they have said, look, we don't like the fact that she would be doing this, because they realize that China is going to react, that they could suddenly find themselves in a military conflict with China simply because Pelosi decided to go on this trip. The White House has also reacted. Biden communicated the Pentagon's concerns to Pelosi. It's difficult to say. It probably divided opinion within the White House itself, but I think there should be a certain amount of concern with regard to this as well. But they officially do not have the role of being able to tell Pelosi what to do because of the division of powers in the U.S. government. But if they were assertive enough, they could make it very clear that they didn't want her to go, and they could effectively stop this, I believe. Whether they would do that or not, I'm not sure.
Well, Kendo Zhu, before I turn to you, I had to take a glance over at the clock to find out how much time we have to look at the different ways that the U.S. disagrees with China on so many issues. I'm not too sure we could fill all of those in. But let's take a look at one of the most recent developments, unless you have one that comes off the top of your head. Go ahead.
No, it's really, I want to point out that, you know, you can ask the questions about this probably very likely upcoming visit to Taiwan. That is, we say provocative, and also you can ask the question, we say it's unnecessary provocation or unnecessary crisis in the making. You can ask for what is the purpose of Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. Yes, we know that she supports Taiwan independence. Well, she wants to be there to show her support. Is that necessary? Because that will create a serious crisis that will undermine the regional peace and stability, that it could bring China and the U.S., you know, a military confrontation. Do we need another crisis around the world right now after we have this, you know, current climate change crisis, heat waves around the world, you know, Ukraine war and food crisis, energy crisis, inflation, etc.? Is she that selfish? Is she simply for her political legacy, because midterm elections are coming, and she understands that the Democrats will lose the control of the Congress, the House of Representatives. She will no longer be the Speaker of the House, and the Republicans, one of them, will become the Speaker of the House. So, I mean, at the age of 1982, she retires very soon. So before her retirement, she wants to make some more controversial visit simply for her political legacy at the expense of China-U.S. relationship. I just don't understand, you know, why? How can anyone, any politician in that senior position, be that selfish?
Well, let's move on to some of these issues that exist between the two, which many have been emanated from the U.S. in many respects. And William Jones, one of them is interchangeable in terms of the way that the news came out almost back-to-back. It had to deal with the South China Sea and then the military sales that happened to Japan and then Singapore at the same time. Now, these two pieces of news are interchangeable in the sense that I'm going to ask you, where you have China saying that on the South China Sea, that the U.S. is making statements regarding this area, but it's distorting the truth. And then it says South China Sea is the common home of regional countries, I'm quoting here, and maintaining peace and stability in the South China Sea is of utmost importance to not only ASEAN countries, but a common demand of China. My question is, are countries in that area actually on board with the U.S. in that aggressive approach towards China?
Well, not entirely. The basic problem is, of course, between the U.S. and China, let's put it mildly, is that the U.S. feels that it now must share or at least discuss with China regarding world affairs, that it is no longer the decider of world politics. And it has been for many years. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the United States was number one, basically could determine what to do, and that's why they could start the wars in Iraq. They could, you know, do all kinds of stuff in the Middle East and get away with it. Now that's no longer the case. Both Russia and China are major powers, and if the United States had a rational attitude, they would realize that somehow we've got to come to agreement with them. But because they have different systems, so-called, they feel that this would be a loss of prestige. So much of this has to do with that fundamental question. Will the other countries come on board, the so-called allies? Well, you have the solid front, I think, of the Anglo-American crowd, including Australia and perhaps even New Zealand. The Japanese have succumbed to this to some extent, although they have a lot of economic ties with China, a lot of economic interest in China, and maybe they would only go so far. But we've seen over the last few days in the meeting between President Xi and President Widodo in Indonesia, we saw in Wang Yi's visit with the Philippines that these are countries who are around the South China Sea who probably don't have the same outlook as China on that, but want to work together with China to resolve problems because they feel that by working together, it's to their advantage as well economically and in many other respects. So I think it's a more difficult call for the United States to pull together a so-called alliance of democracies in the East Asia vicinity, as sure. They have to some extent successfully done in Europe. Even that, though, is not going to hold over a long term either.
Well, Kendo Zhu, you have China coming out making a statement in solidarity with ASEAN countries that is going to further strengthen its cooperation. And at the same time, it will jointly resist all kinds of malicious acts of disruption, as China calls it, and destruction in the South China Sea. So when it comes to ASEAN countries, there's a united stance there from what it appears based on the Chinese point of view. China wouldn't come out and say that if it wasn't sure, I'm guessing, I'm asking you, if ASEAN countries were not on board. So isn't there this underlying unity with China, but in the face of the U.S., maybe not admitting to it as much?
Well, the South China Sea issue is interesting. It's complicated, you know, partly because it's a historical legacy. For example, you know, previously people would talk about the Chinese Nandashi Line. That was a legacy of the Republic of China before the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949. The Republic of China, actually the government, in a sense, is in Taiwan. If you look at the claim about South China Sea, from Taiwan or from the Chinese mainland, it's the same because it's inherited from that time, the previous government. Secondly, so China understands it's complicated. China has put forward this suggestion that is, let's leave aside the differences because, you know, it's about a sovereignty issue. Sovereign claim, it's very difficult to solve that. You know, no country will give up their claim about their, you know, sea waters over there. So let's focus on the working together or the common interests. Let's, you know, jointly develop these resources over there. So in a sense, this is an issue between China, between Vietnam, you know, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, etc. between these countries to find a way to solve this problem. So they are working on this code of conduct, COC, to basically discipline the behavior of every country so we can avoid any differences and focus on the development. But look, about Australia and the US and Japan, including India, they are not, say, party to the claim of the South China Sea. Frankly speaking, you can say it's none of their business in a sense. But of course, you can say, you know, oh, we have the freedom of navigation. You know, freedom of navigation is an idea, basically serving the interests of big powers. You can say for the US, probably, partially, Russia, China, also India. Because for smaller countries, it's just impossible to navigate a warship, for example, along the Atlantic to the close waters of United States or European countries. How is that possible? So fun, but that's also okay. The issue is like, you know, the countries would ask all the countries in the region, China included, they are focused on development, investment, trade. So that's why you have RCEP, Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, focusing on the development because that's a priority of every country in this region. But look, when the U.S. increased its presence here, it's not about economic presence. It's about a military presence. They send more aircraft carrier. They send more warships. They send more helicopters to challenge China, to challenge, you know, including India, actually. So you can see which country is contributing to the peace and stability, because which is necessary for the development, which country is really creating trouble for the region and for the regional countries.
Well, while you were speaking there, I took the time, which I think is very relevant here, William Jones, regarding the number of military bases that the U.S. has in this area in Asia. And I'm very surprised to find this out. I was not aware of this. We know there's roughly about 750 military bases that the U.S. has across the world. But what is surprising here, based on this particular stat, which I can see reflected in a number of sources, that you have, from what it looks like over here, 80,000, up to 80,000, troops that operate from 120 military bases in the Asian territory. So that's about 10%. It's a lot. Does the U.S. then have, because our guests there talked about sovereignty, do the nations that host these U.S. troops not have sovereignty over themselves, especially when it comes to military operations, if directed by the U.S.?
Well, obviously, if the U.S. would deploy these troops in military action, they'd probably be able to do that. The countries could complain about it. But there are agreements that had been made for the stationing of U.S. forces in these areas. Now, what you have to understand, however, is that the United States, which traditionally was not a policeman of the world, after World War II began to follow in the steps of the British Empire. Remember, Franklin Roosevelt wanted to eliminate the British Empire. He didn't want any empire, but he died very quickly. And after that, the general attitude of the so-called policy planners in Washington was that we have to reinstitute the British Empire, because if we don't have them in those countries, we will be in a weak position with regard to the Soviet Union. So there was a push to really make the United States into something like a British Empire. So you see all these troops deployed, similar to what you had in the British Empire. They were deployed all over the world. And the countries have accepted that fact to some extent. But I think there are very grave concerns at the present moment, especially with the war in Ukraine, which is being promoted and pushed by the United States government, and the very provocative policy in the Asia-Pacific region, that if this goes much further, I think many of these countries that have been friendly to the U.S. and have accepted the fact that U.S. troops would be deployed there would maybe start to rethink that. Okay. Perhaps even Australia, which is an Anglo-American country, they're trying to have a better relationship with China. Maybe they would start rethinking the fact that they are allowing greater deployment of U.S. troops there, because it could be a danger to them.
All right, final question goes to you, Ken Dojuan, and the reason why I'm going to address this question to you is because you're in China, and I want to find out from you, what were your thoughts when a few weeks back at the G20, the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, said China is the most serious long-term threat to the world order and universal values?
Well, that's an interesting comment. You know, when he refers to universal values, he means Western values, Christian values. Interestingly, basically his idea is like every country should accept that kind of values. I'm not sure every country, you know, in particular, like countries with a splendid history and civilization, like Iran, like China, like Russia, like Egypt, you know, those countries, somehow they have to accept the U.S. values. Isn't that laughable? And secondly, you know, to say China is a threat to this international order. Well, depends on what kind of order we are talking about. If it's about a UN-centered international order, and then China is the strongest supporter of the UN and all the international organizations. The thing is, the international order the U.S. refers to is really an international order that supports the U.S. hegemony, that supports empire, the U.S. empire in which U.S. dictates the global affairs, in which U.S. will enjoy this superiority.
Okay.
The U.S. enjoys the preeminence. With the rise of China, yes, that's a challenge to U.S. hegemony, unfortunately, you know,
okay,
to the
we'll have to leave
of,
it there.
Of Washington.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That's Ken Doju. Thank you, senior fellow at Pangle Institution from Beijing. William Jones, thank you for your contribution. Executive Intelligence Review from Leesburg, VA. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavoy and the team, it's goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Around half of U.S. seniors living alone can't afford their basic necessities, statistics published recently revealed, underscoring calls for legislation to expand Social Security and lower prescription drug prices. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Around Half of U.S. Seniors Living Alone Can't Afford Basic Expenses, a study shows. Here's the story. Around half of U.S. seniors living alone can't afford their basic necessities, statistics published recently revealed, underscoring calls for legislation to expand Social Security and lower prescription drug prices. 54% of older U.S. women who live on their own and 45% of older men in the same situation are either impoverished by federal standards or cannot cover their necessary expenses, according to the Elder Index, a project of Gerontology Institute at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. For older couples, the figure is 24%. The Elder Index confirms that we already knew the cost of living is just too high for older Americans, and their earned benefits aren't keeping pace with these costs, the Alliance for Retired Americans tweeted in response to the report. Ramsey Alwyn, President and Chief Executive of the National Council on Aging, told Kaiser Health News, KHN, that the group hopes to promote a robust dialogue about the true cost of aging in America. There is a myth that Social Security and Medicare miraculously take care of all of people's needs in older age, said Alwyn, adding, "The reality is they don't, and far too many people are one crisis away from economic insecurity." William Arnone, CEO of the National Academy of Social Insurance, told KHN that the poverty rate just doesn't cut it as a realistic look at the struggles older adults are having. The Elder Index is a reality check. KHN interviewed Fran Seeley, an 81-year-old retired schoolteacher in Portland, Maine, whose monthly income consists of $925 in Social Security payments, $287 from an individual retirement account, and $400 from a reverse mortgage. Seeley's annual income of $19,300 falls well below the $22,560 the index deems necessary for an older adult in excellent health living in a home they own with no mortgage payments. With high inflation straining her budget even further, Seeley said that, "I have to cut back in any way I can. The biggest worry I have is not being able to afford living in my home or becoming ill," she told KHN. "I know that medical expenses could wipe me out in no time financially." The Equity in Aging Collaborative, a new initiative by 25 advocacy groups seeking to address issues of poverty among older adults who have and continue to face inequities across their lifetimes, is planning to use the index to influence lawmakers to enact laws and policies that ease the financial burden of aging. Introduced last October by Representative John B. Larson, the Social Security 2000, a sacred trust, would, if passed as written, increase program benefits, protect against inflation and the 5-month waiting period for disability benefits, strengthen the Social Security trust funds, and implement other measures. Meanwhile, the pharmaceutical industry is fighting to torpedo Senate Democrats' modest proposal to reduce prescription drug prices by requiring Medicare to directly negotiate the prices of a limited number of medications. Surveys have shown that expanding Social Security and allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices are overwhelmingly popular with voters. According to recent data for Progress Polling, 76% of all likely U.S. voters support the former policy, while 83% back the latter. We'll be right back.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.